This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. It is 7:35. The morning run on BFM. Chuang, Xiaoning and Phil with you. Now, up next, we turn attention to the land of the rising sun as Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga is slated to be the first world leader to meet President Joe Biden. That's happening after the 7:30 news bulletin. We're going to come back and talk about, in fact, after the 8 o'clock news with a French gentleman.
Yes, in the Breakfast Grill today, Lin Mark will be interviewing His Excellency Roland Galarag. He's the Ambassador of France to Malaysia in conjunction with International Francophonie Day. The Ambassador of France to Malaysia joins us on the Breakfast Grill for a discussion on how both countries can increase bilateral trade and cooperation in a time of economic uncertainty, as well as sharing the experiences on how both countries dealt with the pandemic.
In the meantime, we're turning attention to the land of the rising sun, Japan, where Tokyo is ending its state of emergency this weekend with the approval of the government advisory panel on coronavirus countermeasures.
Meanwhile, the vaccination program is coming along after a slow start. So Prime Minister Suga received the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine a few days ago as part of preparations to travel to Washington, D.C. in April to meet with President Joe Biden. And Suga also welcomed the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, to the country recently in his first overseas visit. So what does this mean for U.S.-Japan ties going forward? Will relations be as warm as when they were under the Trump administration?
So for a snapshot of where things stand in Japan, we speak now to Jonathan Berkshire Miller, a senior fellow at the Japan Institute of International Affairs. Jonathan, the state of emergency in Tokyo is set to expire on Sunday as scheduled, although case numbers remain high. What factored into the decision to lift restrictions?
Well, thanks very much for having me on. As you noted, now the Suga administration in Japan has formally lifted the state of emergency, not just in Tokyo, but in the neighboring prefectures around Tokyo. I think a couple things factored into this, but the main thing that factored in was that the numbers of infections are now significantly lower than they were earlier this year in their peak. So now the cases in Tokyo are somewhere between 300 and 400 a day. It's not the most ideal situation, but I think it's a big improvement from where it was before. So this hasn't gone without controversy. I think the opposition parties in Japan have said that this is premature and are worried, especially ahead of April is cherry blossom season there. So cherry blossom viewing season. So there's a bit of worry that potentially this is premature, but I think the lifting of the restrictions was done based on the number of cases.
Yeah, so Prime Minister Suga received his first vaccine just a few days ago. Can you share with us how the vaccine rollout is progressing there?
Yeah, so it has been slowly proceeding. I think it's not as quick as Japan would have liked initially. As you said, I think the Prime Minister receiving his vaccine has been a positive element. They're thinking now in April of starting the vaccinations of their senior citizens. So that's going to be an important milestone. But I think the challenge really remains the supplies. So Japan is set to receive, I think, about 100 million doses of both Pfizer and Moderna in June. And their ability to vaccinate everyone by the end of June, July is still an open question. I think that's still the target, is to have all of their logistical supplies by the end of June and then start with a general population in July.
Meanwhile, Prime Minister Suga will be the first leader to have an in-person meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden in April when he visits Washington, D.C. And the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, also chose Japan as his first visit. So just tell us, what does this signify for U.S.-Japan ties?
Well, I think it symbolizes a couple of things. I think there's a lot of continuity in the U.S.-Japan alliance and relationship. I think Japan, like frankly every other country in the world, had some challenges in dealing with the U.S. under the previous administration. But that being said, I think even with the challenges of the Trump administration, many of Japan's objectives were able to be met. That said, I think Japan is an interesting test case for the challenges that allies have faced under the U.S. administration. So the Biden administration signaling to Japan through its initial visit of not just Secretary of State Blinken, but also in tandem with Secretary of Defense Austin, what they call a 2+2. Japan and South Korea being those first two meetings, I think was, you know, a very strong sense of reassurance. And I think coupling this, two important events to couple this with, in addition to Suga's trip to the United States. First of all, it was the Quad meeting, the virtual Quad meeting between the four leaders, India, Australia, Japan, the U.S. but also is this week's meeting between the U.S. and Chinese officials. So the symbolism, I don't think, has been lost on Japan that Blinken and Austin made their first trips to Asia, coming to their allies in Tokyo and Seoul. And meanwhile, the Chinese had to fly to Alaska in the middle of winter for their first meeting with the U.S. So I think that's an interesting kind of contrast of symbolism.
Yeah, so Jonathan, if Japan and America remain best friends, what does that mean for Japan and China, who have never been best of friends?
Well, I think that a lot of this relationship has had its challenges in recent years, and especially in recent months, after the pandemic, and I think there's a number of different factors there. There was a gradual, very, very tentative thaw, I think, happening before the pandemic broke out. And actually, just a year prior, there was thoughts that Xi Jinping might be in Tokyo in April for a state-level visit, meeting with the emperor. So, I mean, things were at a very different state a year ago. It's not that the structural things have really changed in that relationship, but I think the international mood, obviously, on China has shifted. The U.S.-China strategic competition has become more intense, but also some of the areas that are most sensitive to Japan. So, for example, the territorial dispute over the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea has very much intensified. China has just recently changed a Coast Guard law, which has really created concerns in Tokyo. So all of these factors, I think, have put more pressure on the relationship with China.
It's very interesting. I'm quite keen to see how Japan and US work together in combating China. What do you think is the strategy here? Who is going to play what role between Japan and the United States, as presumably both are now more disciplined in addressing China?
Well, I think one of the positive developments of the new Biden administration is that, you know, largely at this point, it's on a bit of a listening tour and a sort of cooperative and coordinative tour with its allies, such as Japan and such as South Korea. So I think that rather than essentially, you know, telling China this is the way it's going to be, I think it's going to do it much more in line with its allies. And there's certain strengths that I think the Japanese have that the United States doesn't have, and vice versa. I think one strength that Japan has in particular is the depth of its relations in the ASEAN region and Southeast Asia. Japan obviously being not only being a member, but being the largest economy in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The Suga administration, in addition to Abe, when Abe first took office in late 2012, both administrations prioritized ASEAN as their first international visits. And Prime Minister Abe, actually before Suga, actually his first 10 countries were in the ASEAN region. So I think this is a big strength that Japan has that the U.S. simply is lacking a little bit in.
But will this give Suga some brownie points? Because domestically, he seems to be falling behind in terms of his popularity vote. And how will that? What implications will that have if Japan were to have elections this year?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that definitely benefited his predecessor, and it usually hasn't been a watermark of success for Japanese prime ministers, but I think in recent times, due to the sort of geopolitical situation, it's been a very big positive, has been to have strength in foreign policy. And that is something I think, you know, frankly, due to the fact of the pandemic and due to the fact that the U.S. election happened as well, Suga hasn't necessarily been able to sort of brandish those credentials. So I think it really is needed, as you noted, especially with some of the domestic headwinds coming his way. I think that the potential for a change in the oncoming election, I think, is a big concern for sure. I think that Suga still has a ways to go to sort of prove himself in the leadership capability as his predecessor.
Jonathan, before we let you go, a quick word from you on whether the Japan Olympics will go on.
Yeah, it's a $1 million question. I think that it will go on. I think it's in what capacity. So there's obviously been reports and rumors out now that they are planning to hold the Olympics, but without spectators, without international spectators. So only residents of Japan, in addition to the athletes. Whether that's actually going to be the final resolution or whether we see sort of a sprinkling of international, like a selected international spectators, dignitaries, a few political figures, sports ambassadors, in addition to the Olympians, that might be an option. Do I see a full-scale Summer Olympics like we've seen before? I think that's going to be very challenging under this current dynamic in July and August. So I think Japan is still sort of sorting through some options, but I think regardless, it's not going to be like the Summer Olympics that we're used to seeing.
All right, Jonathan, thanks so much for your time. That was Jonathan Berkshire Miller, the Senior Fellow at the Japan Institute of International Affairs. I mean, look, the last time a U.S. president came in, right, it was the first Asian leader to meet Trump was actually Abe, Suga's predecessor. This time around, same thing. But one just gets a sense that in terms of both of those superpowers, really missing the boat where ASEAN is concerned. As Berkshire Miller was saying, China does have a much deeper stranglehold in the ASEAN region than either Japan or America have. And they seem to really miss the boat in terms of just, you know, getting some kind of traction. Or have they? I mean,
well, I think that's why the Quad is core, to basically shore up and take ASEAN at the center stage. Perhaps Japan, India, Australia together with Korea, I think can potentially be a match to China.
What I think, guys, the reality is that who practices checkbook diplomacy usually wins, especially in this region, right? Who's going to drive investment? Who's going to drive economic growth in your country? It's going to be your bestie. That's a fact of life.
The one that puts in the most money will win the most brownie points. And look, I mean, anecdotally, how much does Australia do here? How much does India do here, right?
I mean, they're definitely not the top trading partner. I mean, the top trading partner for Malaysia is when you look at Japan, China, US. I'm sure they're all very tightly close, but you see China really gaining in this, right? Yep. And Singapore, for example, China is their top trading partner. So it's just all down to the checkbook.
You know, as a trading bloc, 13 member nations of ASEAN and what, 650 million people, that's rising very fast because birth rates here are going gangbusters, right? And rising economies and GDPs and, you know, urbanization, all that kind of stuff. As an economic bloc, you know, ASEAN will be a force to reckon with, on par with maybe the EU in the not too distant future.
Yeah, but unfortunately, we don't really have a political and economic union. And so far, ASEAN works on the basis of gentle diplomacy.
Yeah, the only side challenge is that ASEAN is in conflict with China over the South China Sea. So that is potentially a sticking point beyond the checkbook.
Okay, up next, whether the Pemakasa stimulus package addresses SME plights. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.